You have a treat in store, a couple of treats. We have two more guest speakers and also very close friends of mine. If you'll open your look at the back of your handout, that first page again, you will see Cynthia Hurst Turner, who graduated in 89, I believe. I was just coming to work here when Cynthia was graduating. I didn't get to know her then, but I've gotten to know her since. And she and I have become fast friends. She's the founder and director of Shep Hurst Meadows, offering intensive outpatient wellness programs for women involved with substance dependence disorder, and A Woman's Way, a specialized treatment program for women suffering from the deterioration of their cognitive, spiritual, and behavioral life due to psychiatric disorders. So Cynthia also, all of our guests are folks that have graduated from RTS and who are working in distinctly different areas from one another, and I asked them to explain those areas and what are the ethical issues that just are a part of their day in and day out work world and ministry world. And so I give you my my good friend Cynthia to spend 15 or 20 minutes with us and inform us about those things. Cynthia, can you put this on, please?
I want to talk to you a little bit about my experience. And interestingly enough, I'm going to open up just talking a little bit about the differences in working with individuals that has substance abuse disorders or substance abuse, either abuse or dependency disorders. And incidentally, how many of you work with individuals who have chemical dependency disorders? And I'm going to include eating disorders in that. Okay. I tell you, I was so fortunate in being able to begin my experience in working in a corporate behavioral health entity. Coming out of RTS, I was speaking with another therapist in line, and she said, you know, I'm just so eager. And I said, I was too, and I still am. But I was so fortunate in the fact that going into that environment, it was very insulated. Of course, I had nothing to compare that to. And at the point in time which I went into that corporate behavioral health setting, I did not realize how well protected that I was and what exactly it was that I was going to learn that would really complement the clinical aspect of training here at RTS. But needless to say, when I left the corporate setting after about 10 years and I went out into private practice and began consulting, shortly thereafter I realized that insulation was gone. But I was so thankful to have had the exposure that I had, simply because in the beginning it felt so rigid. And I remember thinking, there's no compassion in this. And in particular, when I went on to become a patient advocate in the hospital setting, I remember being very excited about that and thinking, this is right up my alley. This is what I've always wanted to do, to be an advocate for patients. But what I realized shortly into that opportunity was that there was a very delicate balance, and that's really where I want to start with you and impose the importance of finding the balance. And I kind of compare it to working with couples that are in stage four conflict, and there's a significant amount of polarization between husband and wife, and you have the husband who's saying, this is what I think I need to do to take care of myself. And the wife is saying, well, this is what I need to do to take care of myself. And I always point out that somewhere in the middle, we've got the relationship. And as a clinician, we have to tend to all three. And these two individuals are very polarized. And so our job is to help them distinguish ultimately what is in the best interest of the relationship. And clearly, sometimes you're going to have a spouse saying or a husband saying, well, this is what's in my best interest. And when we examine that, we're going to see that may be in his best interest, but that really isn't in the best interest of the wife, or vice versa. And so then we have this thing called the relationship as well, in addition to minding and tending to each individual's needs. So when we're looking at behavioral health care, when we're looking at confidentiality, when we're looking at ethics, I learned as a result of being in the role as the patient advocate that every time I went into a conversation, I was tending three things. It wasn't just about best practice for the patient. That's what I thought that was going to be all about. But the reality is, if I was having a conversation with a patient in the role of patient advocate, typically it was involving a complaint. It was something that they had an issue with. So subsequently, I found myself needing to advocate for the patient while simultaneously having to advocate for the facility that I worked, having to advocate for the clinicians that worked on my treatment team, having to advocate for administration. And fortunately, that insulation was there, and it was protective. But I had to be very mindful of what it was. And subsequently, in the end, when it was all said and done, of course, you can imagine that when you have a patient that has a conflict with something that's happening in the system, or you have a family member who has a conflict with something that's happening in the system, okay, then you had that additional involvement of the family, and then simultaneously you have a system, you have a risk manager, you have an HR director who is saying, you've got to follow policies and procedures at all time, and here's what they are. These are non-negotiable. So yes, we want you to do what's in the best interest of the patient. We also need for you to do what's in the best interest of the facility. And oh, by the way, when this is all over, we want everybody to like each other. And that's where the relationship comes in. That determining, finding the delicate balance, what is in the best interest of this patient and their family? What does taking responsibility and ownership look like? What is in my best interest, the best interest of the clinicians, of the corporate system, and ultimately, what's going to be in the best interest of the relationship? When this is all said and done, we all know, I remember something that Dr. Hurley said at some point over the 3 years that I was here, and he said, never forget, when you walk into that room, you're walking on holy ground. So what did that mean? How do I protect, the sanctity? How do I protect the sacredness of this relationship? I have a patient. She came to our facility. She's entrusted these clinicians, our administration, with helping and healing. And now there's a conflict. And I've got three different sets of needs that somehow I have to be mindful of and simultaneously address in such a way that I keep my integrity in check. So I really want to open the few things that I'm going to share with you, introducing you to this concept of we are patient advocates. We have to be all about best practice for our patients, but we also have to be a practice advocate for my practice, for myself as a clinician, and then we also have to be about what is best practice for the relationship in the end after this is over. Will I have preserved that trust? Will I have preserved that therapeutic relationship? And so that's a very delicate balance. So saying that, I want to open by speaking specifically to the most challenging cases I have ever had beyond any other population has been working with men and women with substance abuse disorders. And so specifically, I want to bring your attention to the fact that you all, we're very familiar with HIPAA, right? Everybody knows about HIPAA. How many of you, show of hands, have heard of this code, 42 CFR Part 2? Anybody? You've probably seen it, because if you've looked at anything with HIPAA, that's on there somewhere. But this is very important, because this is a federal law, okay, that supersedes certain guidelines that HIPAA established over 15 years ago regarding confidentiality. There are some things that are different if you as a clinician are working with an individual that has a substance abuse or substance dependency disorder. So I want to give you those numbers again, because if you are working with that population, you've got to know the difference, because this particular federal law clearly distinguishes. There are certain instances where we as professionals cannot release healthcare information if the individual has a substance abuse or substance dependency disorder. Why is that? I mean, it's 3.5 decades later, and the reality is we still have individuals that are being discriminated against because they have a substance abuse history. I was looking through some research recently and ran across a study that was done by Faces and Voices of Recovery, 24% of the people that were surveyed said that they had suffered employment and insurance discrimination because they were honest in stating something about their substance abuse history or dependency history. We know how frequently mothers and fathers lose custody of their children, okay, because of substance abuse disorders. And also in that particular study, 12% of the individuals quoted specific instances in which they were told that the company that they had interviewed with had a policy against hiring someone that had a legal history related to substance, or mood-altering substance. Okay, so this is why the federal government remains somewhat rigid in positioning themselves to say, mental health patients, let's look at HIPAA. Substance abuse, let's look at HIPAA and this specific federal guideline. The other thing that this guideline does that supersedes HIPAA is it also requires that a court order be predicated to a much higher standard. You have to have a particular kind of court order, subpoena, to get a record for an individual who has a substance abuse or dependency disorder. Did you know that? We think all subpoenas are created equal. You know, if an attorney's providing it or we're getting it from a court, we assume that we have to abide by it. I have had subpoenas that I have received that were subpoenas that applied legally to mental health medical records. It wasn't the proper subpoena. I learned that in the hospital. Who would have ever thought that? Thank goodness that I did. So my encouragement to you at this point is be mindful of the fact if you are going to work with individuals that have substance abuse or substance dependency disorders, you need to know the federal guidelines, what they are, and how they supersede HIPAA, okay? I want to share with you a couple of examples that I think that will really solidify my suggestion in working with this population requires a certain sense, a certain hypervigilance, if you will, at times to what you're doing. You and I know in working with this population, we all know and understand keratological defects. And within that, we talk about addiction and we talk about denial. But for some of our patients, they're not even at denial yet. They're still very delusional about their condition. And they're at a certain sense of desperation. So when you're working with substance abuse families and substance abuse patients, you have got to be mindful at all times of everything that is in that medical record. You have got, you know, to check off. You have got to dot your I's and cross your T's because you never know where that information may land. For example, I had a subpoena from an individual that was a licensed professional, okay, and one of my procedures, something that has become a policy and a procedure within our program, is 100% of the time, every time I get a subpoena, within minutes, I'm locating my attorney. Are you in Jackson? Are you in Madison? Are you in New Orleans? I'm sending you the subpoena. That's a non-negotiable for me now. His eyes see it first. The second thing that happens is he calls the attorney. Okay, that is subpoena the records. He starts to ask questions. I naively believed when a record was being subpoenaed that whoever was subpoenaing was interested in information about the patient. When it comes to drug and alcohol patients, there's a lot at risk. Nurses, attorneys, physicians, they have professional license, divorce, custody issues. So I was naive because guess what I learned? Sometimes that spouse whose attorney is subpoenaing the record isn't only looking to discredit the patient's therapeutic experience, but they're looking to discredit who? Me. If they don't accomplish what they set out to do by discrediting the patient's treatment completion and their sobriety and their participation in aftercare, then you know where they're going to go, right? Plan B. Let's look at the facility. Let's look at the clinicians. Let's look at their credentials. Are they practicing outside of their scope? What qualifies this clinician to treat this? Okay. They will keep looking. So I learned naively, when I get a subpoena, I send it to my attorney. My attorney contacts the other attorney. Then he calls me back and he said, I think this, this, and this is going on. But inevitably, fortunately, to this point, I have never had to release a medical record to a requesting attorney. My attorney, if the patient has an attorney, after I notify my attorney, I notify the patient. Say, I want to inform you that I have received a subpoena for your medical record. Were you aware this was forthcoming? And almost always I hear what? No. And then I say, who is your attorney? And hopefully they tell me. And sometimes they say, I don't have one. And when they say I don't have one, I say, thank God I do. Because my attorney is going to initiate an order that would squash that subpoena in order that I only release that medical record to the hands of a judge. Know that that is an option. Okay. Know that that is there for you. I know if that record is in the hands of the attorney, in the hands of a judge, that other attorney is going to have to make a pretty good argument for ever getting his hands on that entire chart. So I'm not only protecting the patient, the possibility that this disgruntled spouse who wants custody of this child and isn't able to get sole custody and wants to prove that this, by the nature of this person's addiction disorder, that they are neglectful and cannot take care of this child, you know, paying attention to all of those, that also ultimately that this spouse could go and report information to this person's licensure board. There could be multiple ramifications of that. So I've got about 3 minutes, and so I want you to be mindful that you have that option, okay, when faced with a subpoena. There are a couple of other examples. I don't have time to share those, so I'm going to skip over those. I will just say briefly, workman's comp. We're talking about consents. We're talking about HIPAA. When you get a workman's comp case, you're going to get a release. The patient is saying, I'm releasing the medical, I'm allowing workman's comp to see my medical record. Another thing that I have learned to do is no matter where the consent comes from, I have the patient come to my facility and sign a consent in front of me detailing every single thing that's in that medical record and checking it off. I've had an instance where in a workman's comp case, the patient said, I don't remember signing that at my attorney's office. That was in the beginning of my depression. I don't remember anything. And no, I don't want workman's comp having my entire file. And I contacted the attorney and I said, you haven't seen this patient's medical record. And you're telling me to release this medical record to the attorney of workman's comp who's trying to figure out how not to pay for this patient's treatment who was harmed on the job. And this patient has a long history of mental illness. So the attorney said, let me see the medical record. And subsequently, he wound up doing the same thing, getting a squash order. And that medical record was not provided to the opposing attorney representing her employer for workman's compensation. Okay. I had another nurse who came in and said, no, I did not agree for the nursing board to get my medical record. I agreed for them to get the intake assessment, and I agreed for them to get the psychiatric evaluation. And I said, look at this consent that you signed. So thus the importance of giving her a consent that clearly identifies exactly what she's giving me permission to release to that entity. Is it inconvenient to have to come to the office? And do I often hear, no, I've already signed one of those. And I said, yes, you did, but it's very general, and I need to be confident that what you gave them permission to get is exactly what I'm supposed to release to them. 1 minute, 2 minutes, 0 minutes, 1 minute? Okay. Okay, real quick. I want you to be yesterday I got an alert on my phone. When we leave for break, I'm going to put a couple of references, websites up here on the board. I would strongly encourage you to subscribe to these. One in particular, I'll put them up there for you. Is Barbara Giswold. She's a licensed marriage and family therapist. You can subscribe to her. She provides the most fundamental basic information that every one of you need to know on an ongoing basis about insurance issues as it relates to us, changing laws and regulations as it relates to us, new ICD-9 codes, anything related to private practice. It would be very beneficial for you to have that as a resource in order to be in the know. I'm also going to put up a resource that can keep you in the know about the ever-changing laws that have to do with HIPAA. But yesterday, second thing, I received notification. Currently, there are some new 2014 guidelines that have come out under HIPAA. You and I need to know, there are some laws that have changed. And subsequently, we're looking at a minimum of a $50,000 fine, even if it's found that you were not intentionally negligent, and it can go up to a $200,000 fine. So as of yesterday, hot off the press, the laws, 2014 HIPAA guidelines, have been revised, and specifically to address certain issues around the release of mental health information. Okay. The last thing that I will say, and I'm just going to cut this short, is that how many of you have an attorney? Right now, you could pick up the phone and call them and know they were competent to handle your confidentiality issues. If you have one, please stand up. Please stand up. I don't do this to embarrass you, but all of you that don't have one yet, look around you. These professionals do. Have a conversation with them. Go up to them and ask them, who is your attorney? Because when you're in a situation, you don't want to need one and have one. That's not the time to start looking for a competent attorney to address the ethical and confidential matters that we do have. So please, if you have a good, strong attorney, someone approaches you, be willing to share that. We may be generating a lot of business for somebody, but that's okay. It's about us finding the balance and taking care of ourselves. Thank you.